take a network break. This week, Drew has snaffled all the virtual donuts and gone on the run to an undisclosed location. The special operations recovery team that I sent to get them back hasn't been heard from for over a week, and I fear the worst. But do not worry, dear listener. We have drafted in Ned Bellavance from the Day 2 Cloud podcast. Welcome to the show, Ned.
Thank you, Greg. Excited to be here.
Well, this week, in celebration of my own recent holiday, I'm encouraging you to get a masala chai tea and a plate of virtual baklava and feast your virtual self while we perambulate with passion through our sweet selection of tech news and industry analysis for this week. But first, let's pay for the tea and the sweets. Today's show is sponsored by TUFIN. TUFIN has pioneered a policy-based approach to network security management using automation and analytics. You can make network changes in minutes instead of days, reliably and securely. TUFIN, the security policy company. Find out more at TUFIN, that's TUFIN.com. And today's show is also sponsored by ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes gives you performance visibility from every user to every app over any network, both internal and external, so you can migrate to the cloud, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experiences. Sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers and choose your free ThousandEyes t-shirt. And if you like this show, The Network Break, check out our other podcasts on the Packet Pushers Network, like Day 2 Cloud. Get nerdy tech analysis, compelling conversations about infrastructure, professional development, and so much more. And Ned, why don't you, seeing as you're here, why don't you tell us a little bit about Day 2 Cloud?
Yeah, how wonderfully convenient. So Day 2 Cloud is all about what happens when cloud stops being polite and starts getting real. On the show, my guests talk about various topics related to Day 2 Cloud operations, including network considerations, choosing the right tool set, and dealing with imposter syndrome in a landscape that is constantly shifting. Cloud doesn't stay still.
No. As we saw last week with the origin, the hack where they blew through the WAF to get at the database and leaked out that data. It was just the complexity of AWS that let the hackers in.
Oh my goodness, yes. Yes. Complexity on top of complexity. Mm. Yeah, fun times.
Well, let's start off with some FU. Kevin wrote in with some follow-up and he said he was making a point that I see the features that we lump into SD-WAN as something that should have happened eons ago. So the vast number of features that we associated with SD-WAN could have been slowly bolted onto VPN concentrators or branch routers or whatever. And he says that he thinks the root cause of SD-WAN is a separate product because of the stagnant firewall security market. Now, I agree with that point. The reason that SD-WAN is different is because the actual operating systems that we have in our routers and in our firewalls are not able to add deep packet inspection engines and multipathing. So that is the, if you understand the internal architecture of these devices, a lot of them don't run x86s. If they have operating systems, they're often real-time operating systems like Sixwind or VxWorks or, you know, one of the many real-time, and they're not Linux. And so it's not really possible to just go in there and say, add a deep packet inspection engine. Like a lot of SD-WAN companies actually go and buy their deep packet inspection from companies like Qosmos. They buy a library and they go and buy the CLI from companies like TailF. Or there's a range of companies out there who sell networking software that you just snap into your operating system. And quite a lot of the existing operating systems of the market aren't actually written by our vendors. They're actually libraries bought in on a license and then bolted into the core operating system. That's all changing now that companies are becoming software companies to a lesser or greater extent. But most of those products of yore are old and cannot be delted, and so they'll go into the bin. This is why you won't see SD-WAN in an ASA or any of the modern firewalls from Cisco or from Palo Alto's, because Palo Alto, for example, runs on an ARM processor. They run Linux on ARM, which limits their future capabilities. SD-WAN is an emerging market, and it makes more sense for vendors to package up a new product and sell new. That makes them more money. If they go back and try and upgrade, there's no money in that. You get more money by saying, throw the old stuff out and start again. The reason that SD-WAN is what it is partly because of the way customers buy. They don't want to upgrade. They want to replace. Vendors want to make more money, so they package a new product. And also, the old products are often not upgradable. Make sense to you?
Well, I mean, I know the Frankenstein that is IWAN that came out of Cisco, where they did try to sort of backport functionality, and that didn't go well. So I can see why a new product makes sense.
Cisco's problem there, too, was that they were trying to make the most of what was in place, and modern overlays aren't that way. They just, you've got to start again. And they're also, the IWAN was premised on the fact that everything would happen in the network, and SD-WAN is very much controller-centric. So there's a controller usually in the cloud somewhere that does all the operations. So the idea of using, you know, some sort of consensus distributed software to come up with a dynamic, flexible, always changing, that didn't scale and failed. Cisco ran out of money. You couldn't keep throwing money at IWAN while SD-WAN companies were making hay. And eventually Cisco had to buckle under and make an acquisition. They bought Viptela in the end.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, speaking of acquisitions, VMware has announced its acquisition of Veriflow. Now, Veriflow is a modeling company or modeling technology. We've talked about them on the podcast. There are shows in our history about Veriflow. That's where you use a software app to go out to all the devices in your network. You pull all the configurations, you pull state, and then you create a software model. And so that means that you can then test the network. So you can literally do a flag test. You can say, here's all the tests that I need. I need this packet to get from here to here. Is that path valid? I need, 20 megabytes of traffic between these two points. Is that still going to work if I make this change? And that's what Veriflow is going to do. And I think Veriflow is a really good acquisition for VMware because it was very software-centric, very generic. And I think the recognition here is that VMware needs to be a networking company. So NSX, did you have a look at this, Deb?
Yeah, I took a brief look into sort of what Veriflow does and how it fits into the larger VMware future. And I think networking, like you said, that's key to what VMware is trying to do. They want to be your multi-cloud overlay when it comes to networking. So wherever you are, VMware wants to be there too, whether it's, AWS, Azure, whatever. And they also have NSXT and VeloCloud filling out their SD-WAN. Mm-hmm. So they've got network all over the place. And they do have an existing network analysis tool called vRealize Network Insight. And the press release specifically calls out how great it is in the same release that they're talking about how they're buying another company to do what Network Insight
does. Yeah, that's the old AppNetta product. And AppNetta was much more of a visibility tool, not a modeling tool.
Right. I actually used AppNetta that had to be 8 years ago. I think before they VMware bought them. This is really to fill out their capabilities when it comes to multi-cloud. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about what they might be doing with this on the campus side of things.
Well, I don't think VMware cares much about the campus at this point. I think their real goal is to own the cloud and the multi-cloud. So the on-prem, off-prem, public cloud, private cloud, multi-cloud, Google, AWS, Azure, Alibaba, IBM, all that sort of stuff. And I think they're still focused on that market and the campus and the branch. With VeloCloud, they're reaching into the branch. Will they go into the campus? I don't know. I don't think the campus matters as much as it used to, in the sense that 5G might mean that laptops could just connect to 5G, and why bother? It's only going to matter in some markets. It'll matter more in some markets than others. Like in the US, where telecommunications is much more expensive, say, than others. In the UK, it's getting to the point where you could just attach your laptop to 5G, unlimited data, and away you go.
Right.
So why do you need a campus, or just connect to the wireless? Do you really need to be? And the thing about wireless is it has NAC built in, so you get your access control, whereas it's wired Ethernet that's the problem.
Right.
I think you could just wait it out. VMware might just want to wait that out and wait for the trend and see if wired Ethernet actually matters enough for it to be a big enough market.
Yeah.
But I think this modeling acquisition is important because networks are much more complex now. So software devices have resulted in an explosion of network functions. I mean, look at just NSX. It's got firewalls, layer 4, L7, load balancing, switch routing. How do you, if you start configuring some of those things, or if you're in AWS and you've got VPCs, or you've got a big switch VPC underneath the AWS, how do you model all of that? So if I make this change, does this break something? And that's what Veriflow gives them. I'm quite certain that this will be quite good for especially bigger companies with bigger networks and lots of VMs in lots of different clouds. You'll finally have a tool that'll stop you from going insane, basically.
Well, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, NSX knows about what it knows about in its own environment, but it doesn't really have visibility outside of its own little world. So having a tool that can help broaden that horizon to stuff that doesn't live under NSX makes a lot of sense.
I've just dropped a joke in here. I noticed there's a tweet going around on the internet about AWS messaging. We talked about multi-cloud there several times and many clouds. And in AWS's branding guide, I quote, AWS does not allow or approve the use of terms multi-cloud, cross-cloud, any cloud, every cloud, or any other language that implies designing or supporting more than one cloud provider.
Of course they don't.
I've said this many times on the show, and people do often email me and say, no, they don't. AWS knows. And I'm, no, literally, in his in their branding guide. I can send you a link if you're interested. That it says there is only one cloud, and that is AWS. AWS refuses to acknowledge any other clouds in the world. So there you go. Just in case you don't think that AWS is arrogant.
Oh, no. One of my friends went to go work for AWS, and before he could even talk to a customer, he had to go through a 2-week boot camp of branding and appropriate language, basically. he has to be very careful about the words he uses when he's speaking publicly to anyone.
Wow, that sounds like a fun place to be.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, no, hard pass on that one.
Hard pass, yes. And don't forget the non-compete. If you ever move to a state in America that has a non-compete, you'll never work in that state again. You can never leave. It's yep. Hotel California. Anyway, moving on, Xeris changes hands. So Xeris is a wireless company that many years back in the days when there was many small wireless companies all fighting for space, Xeris changed hands a few times. It went to Motorola, and then I believe it went to Riverbed. And in this case, Riverbed is now selling the Xeris Wi-Fi networking technology suite over to Cambium Networks. Now, Cambium Networks is usually known for its long-haul or point-to-point outdoor wireless networking capabilities. So I think this is Xeris is becoming a campus play for them, so they can extend their point-to-point portfolio and start to say, and we've got a campus play, and they can build and grow the company from there. What do you think?
It's not that surprising that they've decided to do something. They went IPO in late June of this year, and they priced themselves at $12, which was below what they originally wanted to price at. After their IPO, rather than having a big pop, they have dropped down to $8 a share, and they missed a bunch of targets for Q2. So I guess they're looking at a way to find growth through synergy with another company, bring something more into their portfolio to differentiate themselves from what's probably a pretty crowded marketplace. It takes time and money to merge companies together, and it doesn't always go that well. So they've got an uphill battle.
Xeris has lost momentum. I mean, when Riverbed bought it in April 2017 to boost its branch Wi-Fi, and I think they had plans of becoming a campus SD-WAN type play, and they bought Acedo in 2016, which gave them a branch wireless, and I'm not sure that Riverbed's really made that much of a dent in the SD-WAN market. So maybe getting rid of Xeris is an acknowledgement that their campus strategy needs to go. You know, they're just going to focus on the SD-WAN, the WAN acceleration, you know, obviously as an extension of its WAN acceleration expertise. Maybe Riverbed is pivoting away or into the market where it's being successful, as it also is struggling financially, I think.
Yeah, they certainly have a history of selling off components that they don't think are core to their business anymore. They sold off their old load balancer, which I think was called Stingray. That had to be about 3 or 4 years ago because it was no longer core to what they were trying to push as a business.
Yeah, so they thought that they would go from WAN into load balancing and become go head to head with F5 as an expansion. And as you say, not everything works.
Not everything works. No.
Well, now you've brought me an article here about CenturyLink getting into the edge. So why don't you take this one?
Yeah. So CenturyLink announced a couple weeks ago that they were investing heavily in the edge. And this past week, they announced that they are investing several hundred million dollars in more than 100 edge computing locations across the U.S. Quote, forward-looking companies seeking the advantages of next-gen IoT, AI, and machine learning applications increasingly need distributed solutions from the local edge to the public cloud core that combine compute, storage, and networking in an integrated package. So we've got every single buzzword you could possibly want packed in there. Despite all the crooning about how they're spending a lot of money, this isn't actually all that much money to spend on a venture. They said hundreds of million dollars, which is really just code for less than $500 million. We're investing $500 million in Edge or something similar.
It seems like a lot of – they're talking here about 100 initial Edge compute locations. So basically, I would read this as they've got these things called central offices. If you remember back in the day, telephone equipment was big. And they have little buildings all over the countryside where they used to build COs, as they call them, central offices. And they were the telephone exchanges. And I think they're dreaming that those central offices can be turned into edge compute. There's a business there.
I think that's exactly what they're doing. You know, CenturyLink is kind of struggling or has been struggling. They're getting a lot of pressure from the other more successful data center and networking companies, Equinix, for instance. They've been, you know, killing it on the data center and cross-connect front. They grew by 10% in the last quarter, whereas CenturyLink, they were down 4% in Q1 and 5% in Q2 of this year. and they had to take a $6.5 billion write-off for goodwill impairment, which heavily implies that people don't like CenturyLink very much.
Well, I think the goodwill impairment is that they value their brand value or the company value, mm-hmm. and then they realized actually that they didn't. And so they wrote it down.
Right.
And a lot of telcos are in trouble. We saw last week GTT Communications in trouble. And CenturyLink is a backhaul provider, but it doesn't – that's fine, but that's like being a sewage company. Not very glamorous. You don't get a multiple no. for you know, moving the poop around the place and doing the processing. I find it hard to believe that central offices can work. I mean, for example, I would compare this to what Cloudflare is doing. We talk about Cloudflare in the next article about its IPO. But Cloudflare is doing a much better job of edge compute than what this is. This is like asking a leopard to change its spots. I'm going to become a data center hosting provider in a massively distributed environment. I've got all these buildings, so if only I build data centers in them, maybe we can work out how to make money out of them. Fingers crossed.
You know? Exactly. I feel like in order to save their skins a little bit, they're trying to come out with a new message about their branding that we have this new option and we know Edge is going to explode. 5G is coming. So we're going to build out all these mini data centers on the edge to take advantage of that and offer that functionality up to, they're saying they want to target hyperscalers, enterprise customers, wireless carriers, and system integrators. And bring low latency to all of them. They were promising sub 5 millisecond latency for basically anywhere in the US is kind of what they're going for.
That's fine for the US, but if I'm a company that wants to buy edge compute, I don't want to just buy it in the US. I need a global footprint.
Yes, and right? there's other companies that you could go to that will give you that more global footprint. So I think it's probably a step in the right direction for them, but it might be a step too late, or they'll just become a bit player in the larger edge market.
I mean, they could do this and then go and sell those data centers to Cloudflare, but it's Cloudflare that's going to like sell access, like share those facilities to somebody like Cloudflare, who will then just go along and put a half a rack in of all their stuff. But Cloudflare is going to make the money out of this, not CenturyLink per se.
Yeah, they didn't mention anything about hardware or other partners. So I'm imagining what they're really just doing is creating the buildings and putting in the cooling and power and the networking.
I think this is putting out a press release and then seeing if anybody sniffs at it. It's like, you know.
Well, I sniffed and it didn't smell that great.
I think I can agree with you. Well, right, Cloudflare listed its S-1 this week, announcing that it wants to prepare to go for a listing. They haven't said when they're going to go for a listing. We did, talk about Cloudflare in the context of 8chan over the last 2 or 3 weeks, and I had hinted at the time that Cloudflare was probably going to list and in the end decided to drop 8chan because of the bad publicity as it went for an IPO. I think I'll just give myself a pat on the shoulder there because that looks pretty, you know, bad press is not good for an IPO. So getting rid of 8chan. I want to point out, though, that since Cloudflare dropped 8chan, 8chan is still down, like it's gone from the internet. It's funny how that happens, isn't it? Nobody wants to be involved with Nazis.
They did manage to find another hosting provider briefly, but that hosting provider was renting hosting from a larger company. And when the larger company found out, they pulled not only 8chan, but that hosting provider off of their service as well.
More generally, I would note that a number of investor articles are actually still highlighting that Cloudflare profits from these hate sites. And I suspect that I appreciate Matthew Prince's personal point of view, and he owns 20% of the company. So his personal point of view actually does have weight within the business. He's not just the CEO of a company. You know, we need to be open and we need to allow free speech. But at the same time, it doesn't have to be on your network. Right, you can choose as a business owner whether you do business with certain customers because they may not be good for your business. And I suspect Mr. Prince is discovering that hosting hate and Nazi and terrorist content on your network may not actually be good for business in the long run. Still continues to support a fairly large number of other sites which have extreme content which would not be perfectly acceptable.
Right, and I think it's a balancing act, and they kind of alluded to that in their S-1 filing. It has two interesting quotes in there. The first one, and this is under the risks section, is activities of our paying and free customers or the content of their websites and other internet properties could cause us to experience significant adverse political, business, and reputational consequences. But then they followed it later in a paragraph saying, conversely, actions we take in response to those activities of our paying and free customers up to and including banning them from using our products may harm our brand and reputation. So they're saying a little bit of damned if you do, damned if you don't. Yeah.
Generally, the Cloudflare business looks pretty sound. When I had a look through the S1, it's not a WeWork. It's not this dreamy sort of, you know, we're going to make life better for everybody. It's actually pretty practical IPO. And I actually looked to Cloudflare as an example of an edge computing company. So they are really, they're putting, you can write code and distribute it to the edge. They've got a range of services. They're securing DNS services. Really, a lot of their product portfolio is increasing quite substantially over the last year. So kudos to them for that. And they actually have revenue. So they're not like a dreamy Silicon Valley company saying, what, money? Why would we want that? They're actually running a serious business.
Yes, they actually have a path to profitability as opposed to WeWork.
Well, let's take this moment to say thanks to a sponsor. And Tufin is our sponsor here today. As IT cloud environments become increasingly complex and vulnerable to attack, the network change process can become a security-driven bottleneck. Tufin has pioneered security policy management platform to bring automation and analytics to security and network operations, and each change can be implemented in minutes instead of days. So that is, they run a software app, which in the old days was used to configure firewalls reliably and at speed, large numbers of a wide range of firewalls, and they're now extending that to security and network operations so that you can automate access changes across firewalls and hybrid cloud platforms. You can define and enforce centralized zone-based segmentation using the Tufin platform to strengthen your security posture. You can ensure compliance with corporate security policies and regulations from a central console for real-time change tracking, including who made the change and why. If you run a lot of firewalls, companies have been running Tufin for this, and Tufin's now expanding that into network operations, as we saw, you know, other companies are starting to do. And at the same time, you're going to gain visibility and control for security policies, network connectivity, visibility into hybrid cloud platforms. Tufin's console provides policy analysis, search and optimization capability, and facilitates connectivity analysis, and will even help you with troubleshooting through an accurate and interactive topology map of your network. So you want to find out more, head on over to tufin.com. That's T-U-F-I-N.com. And we thank them very much for their support of the Packet Pushers. Pushing on, this week I was drawn to my attention that Mikrotik, that's M-I-K-R-O-T-I-K, have announced a 24 by 10 gig switch with 2 by 40 gig uplink ports with dual power supplies for the very high price of $500.
Wow.
Can you think about that? 24 by 10 gig, 2 by 40 gig, and it's $500. It's got dual power supplies. So this is pretty much enterprise ready, but only $500. What do you think about that?
The price was the shocker on there. I like the dramatic pause. It was definitely worth it. $500, 24 by 10 gig. The only surprise here to me is, I know you've said it a few times, that 40 gig is not, it's kind of a dead technology. So surprised to see 40 gig as opposed to like 2 by 50 or 2 by 25. But aside from that, it's solid specs all around. If you're looking for something to function as a, I guess, a router, this could be
fancy
a really
software. I was chatting to someone the other day, and he said he uses this widely in telco deployments using the Ethernet, using ERPS, Ethernet Redundancy Protocol, which is a ring type protocol for Ethernet to run, you know, small size, medium size telco deployments. To give you a low-cost ring for simple, long deploy, and he's been running it for 5 years with no problems. He's a big fan. He has entire businesses all over the world running these Mikrotik routers today. It runs on a Marvel Prestera DC ASIC. That ASIC is a little bit old, and that's why it's 40 gig.
So, gotcha. Okay.
And because it's a previous generation ASIC, it's nice and cheap, though, right? So,
Stable software on relatively inexpensive hardware. Mm-hmm. How is this even possible or allowed?
Well, for 500, somebody said to me, oh, but the power supplies aren't removable. I said, just think of the whole switch as removable.
Absolutely.
Because the price of that switch is cheaper than a Cisco SFP module cable, right?
That whole switch is an FRU.
That's
what it is.
Yeah. Oh, cheaper, you know, I could buy one Cisco power supply for the price of three of these switches.
Absolutely.
And that gives me six power supplies, you know, just leave them powered off in the rack and have a methodology. So I just thought I'd mention that. I think it's interesting to highlight that we don't always see the impact of white box above the line. But this one, really, if you're a smallish business or you've got a specific need in a telco environment, there's certain cases where this would be absolutely the thing for you. So nice to see it. Moving on to our next hot topic for today, Pivotal is being ingested by VMware. VMware's got the wallet open. the MWs not always spend a lot of money on companies. So to see it get the see the moths fly out when they to buy two companies is a bit odd.
True.
Yeah. Now Pivotal should be in your wheelhouse. I'm not a huge Pivotal fan myself. I've had a run in with them when they were as part of EMC, and I was not overly impressed with the product. What's your thoughts?
I would tend to agree with you. I am not a huge Pivotal fan either, and I've spoken to a few people who've been through Pivotal deployments, and they also are not huge fans. Mm. Pivotal's been a private company for a while. It got spun out of VMware and EMC back in, I believe, 2012. Mm-hmm. At the time, the VMware CEO, Paul Meritz, moved out of VMware and became the CEO of Pivotal at that time. And then Pivotal decided to go public in 2018 with an IPO that was priced at $15. And initially, investors were super bullish on Pivotal. They thought it was going to do really well. They had probably done some creative accounting to have a really good first quarterly report. And so their stock jumped up to $30 a share. And then reality set in, and they had a very dismal Q2 this year, losing $31 million. Yeah. And the stock dropped down to $8.30. Yes. The main reason they cited for that is that they were slow to adopt Kubernetes into their platform. And I would guess that their current efforts to do so are encountering significant technical challenges. They have a very opinionated platform that has very tightly coupled components, which makes it really hard to slap in a new orchestrator and have it work properly.
Well, they run container like the idea behind containers was that you were microservices, and they have the original Pivotal software platform was container like, but it wasn't containers.
They sort of rode that initial wave of cloud native before the tool sets were really mature. So they got out there first, and you know their platform is called Cloud Foundry, and they're all about microservices and quick deployments. And they were also about paired programming. If you wanted to onboard with Pivotal, you actually had to fly your whole development team out to like a Pivotal training site and train with them side by side so they could show you the way, the truth, and the light.
That's really, and so this is what I think is happening is the business model of Pivotal's lost its relevance. So that's a really 2005 idea, you know. All right, we're going to do this. Everybody gets on a plane, goes to a conference, gets rah-rahed, and we train them and we show them the new way, and then we come back and it's all done. It's a one and done. And the pair programming idea was intended to reinforce that idea. So this is what I call a top-down product. So you go and sell it to the CIO, and that's something the CIO, you know, you're going to take all my staff and you're going to train them, and then they're going to be helping each other. We're going to force them into a model where they pair program, and they have to run it on this infrastructure so I know exactly what's happening, and we're going to go microservices, and we're going to be cloud. And it was a perfectly made product that cynically sells to CIOs, but the developers down on the ground, I would say less than one in three developers on the ground liked the Pivotal idea. That I think pair programming is quite widely despised.
That is, I've seen that firsthand working with some clients in my old consulting world. Can't mention any names, but there was a very large company whose top brass had purchased Pivotal and it was being pushed down through the development stack and meeting significant resistance because of the way that they do things.
But I think the world changed though, right? So developers,
The
developers are in charge, not the CIOs. The CIOs have to go to the developers and beg them to do it, right? It's very much, and I think Kubernetes came along and said, this is the right infrastructure, and it's open enough that developers can climb around it, and they would rather be running Kubernetes than on some other, you know, Mesosphere has had to go to Kubernetes, Docker's moving to Kubernetes, so Pivotal has to move, and they've been too slow.
Now, VMware and Pivotal, like I said, have very close ties. And one of the ways that VMware has been trying to embrace Kubernetes is by using Pivotal's platform called PKS, or Pivotal Kubernetes Service, which it works on both on-premises and in the cloud. Mm. And it also has a managed version as well as an unmanaged version. So you can deploy it yourself, or VMware will run it for you. So VMware sees Pivotal in trouble, and this is a product that they have heavily bet on.
So they're going to bring it in-house. There's a number. One of the things that Pivotal did was it sold its shares to some of its customers. So Ford, for example, spat out $300 million to buy Pivotal shares. And there was a range of other companies that bought Pivotal shares. Like, not only are we going to go with Pivotal, we're actually going to buy the company to make sure that we're in control of this product. We're betting the whole company on it. Mm-hmm. And then Ford had to write down $180 million on that investment. I get the sense that VMware might be digging some of their customers out of the poop here. If you're the CIO of Ford and you're looking at Pivotal, you might be going to VMware, why would I do business with you? You've already nailed me. You got me, yeah. Right?
And so basically, VMware has said that they are going to buy Pivotal for $15 a share. It was the initial announcement. Now may have gone up or down since that initial announcement. They're still in talks on how they're going to do this exactly. But considering it was trading at $8, I mean,
80% premium, right?
That's ridiculous how much more they're willing to pay when they could get it for a lot less. So yeah, I think you might be right.
They're rescuing some customers. They're giving customers an out. They're going to spend a few hundred million to make some of their customers look good as they go out. And also, I think my point was that VMware sees this as a chance to buy Pivotal customers and bring them onto VMware. And you're right about the PKS. It was something I hadn't actually considered when preparing for the show. Is they want to give them a path. They don't want to abandon those customers and say, hey, go and get Google Anthos.
VMware needs that Kubernetes story because everybody else has one, and this is the one they chose to go with.
Yeah.
So they need to keep that product up and running, and why not just bring it in-house and throw all the developers they need to at it?
Yeah, and I think this highly opinionated platform thing is dying. I think what we're also – perhaps the big signal here is highly opinionated worked for a short period of time, but over time, having a highly opinionated approach doesn't. You're only going to attach to a small part of the market, which is okay when you're a small company. But as you grow, you need to have more. You know, if more than half of programmers are flatly refusing to work in pair programming, your ability to penetrate the market's pretty limited.
So, yep.
Well, let's take a moment to thank our sponsor, ThousandEyes. Now, ThousandEyes helps organizations deliver business-critical service by providing performance visibility and actionable intelligence from every user over any network to every app, including Office 365 and Salesforce. Now, the way that it does it is by using cloud agents and enterprise agents and endpoint agents, ThousandEyes gathers unique insights on network behavior, on the topology of your network, and how it affects application performance. And then they present it to you in intuitive visualizations to break down what's actually happening on the networks that you own, your internal networks, and the ones you don't own, that is the public WAN or somebody else's WAN if you need to monitor that. And that reduces the troubleshooting time and helps you pinpoint root causes. ThousandEyes can help you by generating performance data through active monitoring techniques from global vantage points. They have probes all over the internet monitoring it and getting visibility into that. We've talked about them on the show a number of times on that point. They can also correlate multiple layers of performance data from layer 7 through 3. Also ingest BGP routing information and DNS to find problems and to reduce mean time to repair. By being able to pinpoint the root cause of faults, to congestion, Wi-Fi quality, DDoS attack, hijacks, route links, DNS failures, you can then get things done a lot faster. And it's all on event dashboards with a whole bunch of visualizations that you can collaborate with the rest of your team to resolve problems. You can even share them with your service provider while they're telling you that it's not their fault, and you can prove it to them and then make their lives miserable, which is one of my favorite things to do. And here's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. Sign up for a free account at www.thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. ThousandEyes, thrive in a connected world. And we thank ThousandEyes for their support. Without them, it wouldn't be possible. One of my favorite bugbears, the Ethernet Alliance, is back in the news this week. The merger with the Enbase T Alliance. The interesting part here is that the Ethernet Alliance is the pre-meeting meeting for the IEEE Ethernet 802.1 committee. The Enbase T Alliance, of course, was the body that developed the 2.5G and 5G standards outside of the IEEE group. And then when they were finished, they took them into the Ethernet Alliance, which then took them into the IEEE group. And now that the Enbase T piece of work is done, it's folding its resources or the work that it's delivered into the Ethernet Alliance, and so passes the Enbase T Alliance. Just wanted to let you know, really. Any thoughts?
Nothing specific. When we're talking about 5G, you're talking about 5 gig across.
Yeah, 5 gig, yeah.
Across your existing Cat 5e and Cat 6 cabling. So I guess really the main reason they did this was if you want to get increased speed over your existing cabling as opposed to running new cabling, here's a new standard that will support that. And I believe the hardware is already out there, as is always the case with these standards.
It's a good way to make
the hardware hits first.
So far, I think it's a good way to make old switches more expensive. So that's really, I think most people would be, people saying to me, for some customers, it's better off keeping the cabling and replacing the switches. I suspect that the real answer here is we should have had power over fiber. It would have made more sense to run fiber optic cable in a Wi-Fi that had a power over instead of trying to extend the life of the existing. I respect the fact that it exists, but I don't think that this will, you know, in a few years, we'll look at 2.5 gig and 5 gig Ethernet and go like, wow, that lasted a while, 6 months, and let's move on. Also, speaking of things that are weird and strange, the tariffs. The U.S. government has been playing with tariffs on China. First of all, President Trump announced that he's going to slap an extra 10% of tariffs on all goods imported from China, so all the goods that aren't currently. And now he's announced that he's going to not do that. He's going to delay it till December. And this, of course, has lots and lots of problems.
Yeah, and in standard form, you know, make a big blustering deal. I'm going to put 10% across the board and then slowly roll that back over time as people forget about what you initially said. Now, the reason that at least some of these goods are going to be waiting until December 15th, that's when the tariff will come into effect for mostly consumer electronics. So we're talking like cell phones, laptop computers, video game consoles.
So that means Christmas won't be affected by the tariffs.
Exactly, because if the tariffs were there, goods would cost more during Christmas, which means either customers have to pay more or the retailers have to take a bigger hit. Either way, not a great net impact for anyone.
Not a vote winner.
And yes, we do have the 2020 election coming up in the United States, and a number of economists are predicting a recession in that time period, at least in part due to this ongoing trade war. And one could say that getting reelected during an active recession is somewhat challenging.
Yes, usually most presidents reelected on good news, economic good news.
Right. Whether or not they're actually responsible for it.
Yeah, that's right.
If the economy is looking good, they tend to get reelected.
That's a broad statement, but it's generally true as I understand it. I think the interesting thing about the tariffs is not the tariffs themselves, it's the uncertainty. This idea that we're going to do it, then we walk back from it, and then we change our minds. And then China obviously is also making its own reactions to these moves, which confuses things. We've seen the IT vendors announce that they're going to source goods through Vietnam or Indonesia or other countries around the world. And a lot of that isn't actually what they do is just ship the goods to Vietnam, put them in a new box and ship them to the US, and then it's tariff-free, right? So there's a lot of but that's not good for companies because they have to go through the pain, and if they have to keep expending effort on the supply chain, that still adds cost. I think overall, the U.S. customers should expect the costs of IT products to rise, even in the face of the supply chain hacks, because ultimately they will be squashed. I don't think the U.S. government wants to see that people sort of squirming around the intent of the rule by, you know, putting in side, you know, attacking it from the sideways. But I think also what we're also not necessarily talking about with the tariffs is the reverse of this, which is where Chinese companies are stopping buying U.S. goods en masse. So we saw in Cisco's financial results. I'm not going to talk about Cisco's results today, particularly because we've well over time already. But Cisco announced that they had real troubles in the Chinese market, something like their service provider business shrank by 25%, and they lost 1% of their total service provider revenue because Chinese companies aren't buying anymore. They're not even being asked to tender. They're just being locked out of entire accounts. In fact, in an interview with the Financial Times, falling demand in the UK, Cisco's second biggest market after the US, was the single biggest factor in declining orders from big corporate customers, Chuck Robbins said in an interview with the Financial Times. So the UK market is having an impact. The Chinese market's having an impact. And then Cisco also had a $2.9 billion accounting charge, which is a change from how they recognize subscription revenue. Anyway, their shares are basically down 10% today because Cisco is a bellwether stock. If Cisco is having the shakes, the whole technology market tends to get a bit shaky with it.
Right.
And I think this tariffs issue is shaking it. There's also widespread talk amongst the economy. Now, this is not tech news. This is financial news. But if you read the Financial Times and the various, you know, newspapers out there, they're all saying everything is set for a recession. The bond markets have inverted. We look like we're facing a recession. There's the U.S.-China trade war, Brexit, Europe's in trouble, you know, so on and so forth. So if that happens, this will be the first step down that path. So I do think the tariff issue, it's the uncertainty which is the problem, not the fact of the tariffs, perhaps.
Right. The only thing worse than a tariff is an uncertain tariff, because companies don't know which way to go.
So this one's a little bit more esoteric. This is about voice calls. Apparently, the Congress calls on the FCC Commission in the US to start doing something about voice call spoofing, where people use false caller IDs to look like they're coming from safe numbers, after a lot of telcos in the US started to implement spam detection and blocking robocallers and things like that. And the FCC is now proposing some works, but what they're completely failing to realize is that the majority of these spoofing calls actually come from outside of the US. So if you want to fix the problem, you actually have to go to India or Pakistan or Indonesia or Russia or China, which actually runs these call farms, these call, you know, these sweatshops, and stop them from doing, you have to get the telcos in the other countries to do this. And this article, I don't know if you got a chance to read it, Ned, actually highlights that Russia and China are in the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, putting together a process on how to stop call spoofing, and the US isn't even showing up, which I think is an interesting change of power in terms of global telecommunications.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to read the article. I will say, when it comes to the US side of things, the telecom companies are incentivized to allow these calls to keep happening because they make money off of it. So they were doing everything in their power to keep the FCC from imposing any kind of spam filtering or blocking. And it wasn't until Congress stepped in and said, you have to do something because this is awful, that the FCC finally said, okay, now we're actually going to make you do something. And it's not, certainly not foolproof, and I don't think they're intending it to be.
Well, I think the challenge here is that it's not an America-only thing. My point is that America might be is part of a global system, the telecommunications union, and this article is making the point that unless you show up to the global negotiation for this, you can make all the rules you like, but if nobody else is following your rules, it doesn't. It'll have a limited impact, or you won't get the success that you're looking for.
Certainly does make me wonder if they don't want it to work, so they're not going to show up. Well, that's because it's very politically motivated, and politics never follows logic, so it can't be surprising.
Yes. Well, on that note, I think we should wrap it up for today. We have pretty much covered all the news. There's a few topics we're not going to make, I'm afraid, but we don't want to continue pushing this on. Ned, where can people find out more about what you're doing?
Oh, sure. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm Ned1313. I also blog at nedinthecloud.com, and feel free to check out Day 2 Cloud Podcast. I think you really enjoy it.
And of course, if you listen to the show and there's something that you didn't like, or if you've got an opinion to add, or you want to give us some support for some of the things that we've said, head on over to packetpushers.net/FU and send in your follow-up so that we know what your opinions are, and then we'll take them on board at the show so we can always know whether we're getting it right, wrong, or to expand the conversation. Thanks to our sponsors today, Tufin and Thousand Eyes. Without them, it would not be possible for us to put this together for you. Thanks very much to them. You can find me on Twitter as @etherealmind, and I'm blogging on packetpushers.net and working hard on producing content for Ignition, our membership sites. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you enjoy the show, please like us on Facebook, leave a recommendation on Apple Podcasts, or share with your convict. And if you've been listening, thanks for doing that.